Welcome to Justice on Trial. I am Jeremy Dean QC. I have practiced as a criminal defence barrister since 1983, defending in all types of criminal case. This series of podcasts puts the spotlight on the criminal justice system. I will be speaking to government, lawyers, former prisoners, family members, and campaigners, amongst others. I will also be scrutinising the impact of coronavirus, especially upon those who are locked up, as the rest of us are locked down. The criminal justice process is a cornerstone of our free society. Together, let's take a close look at it, its strengths and weaknesses, and whether it serves its purpose. This is Justice on Trial. I'm extremely delighted to welcome Sir Bob Neill, Chair of the Parliamentary Justice Select Committee, a former practicing barrister, and I have very happy memories of having appeared against Bob in court, predominantly at Snaresbrook Crown Court, a long, long time ago. So on a personal level, and also in particular with regard to the issues we're going to discuss, Bob, thank you so much for giving your time up and welcome to this podcast.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Jeremy. It's good to be talking to you again.
Thank you, and you too. Bob, can I begin by asking you about the pre-corona situation as regards the criminal justice process? I mean, how healthy would you say the criminal justice system was prior to the invasion of coronavirus?
Well, I think the truth is, Jeremy, it was already in pretty poor shape. It was struggling. The truth is, and I think we must all take responsibility for this, over a number of decades, under governments of all complexions, we've not invested enough in the criminal justice process. And sadly, what's happened now with the coronavirus has brought to a head, I think, a potential crisis that was bubbling up anyway.
And when you say that successive governments have adopted the same approach, I mean, why do you think it is that what seems to me, and I suspect knowing you certainly seems to you, to be such a cornerstone of our society has received second class attention? I mean, why do you think that is?
I think it's a bit of an indictment on our general public discourse, if you like, Jeremy, because it is a cornerstone. We take it for granted, and that's perhaps because so much of our public debate and discourse is quite superficial and quite short-term. We assume that we live in a country which has the rule of law. Well, we do, but the truth is you have to invest in that. But we assume it's always there. And secondly, it's not as, for want of a better word, sexy in either political or media terms, as things like the health service, things like education. So it's something that's shunted into the background. It's not so fashionable to talk about courts. It's certainly not fashionable to talk about prisons, but we ought to be.
And as regards the vivid description you've given of the state of our criminal justice process, I mean, what would you say are the things about the system that most worried you? We'll come on to the corona era shortly, but what are the things that most worried you prior to the onset of corona?
In a nutshell, I think it has to come down to a lack of investment in both the legal system and also in prisons. But also, I think, particularly in prisons, an unwillingness to take bold decisions about what is the purpose of imprisonment really about. We have a problem that, in a sense, prison system in particular, but the whole of the justice system, really, certainly the work of the Ministry of Justice and its agencies, are a downstream department.
Yeah.
They pick up the consequences of things which have happened across society as a whole, we might argue, and for which they don't have the policy lead, but they have to pick up the tab very often. And we've never been honest about that. So it was lack of money and also a lack of a genuinely joined-up approach across agencies. And by that I mean not enough even now. Although it's improved, but still not enough in terms of early interventions, linking with the education system, with the healthcare system, with the social services system. we're building on it from where we were, but it's still nowhere near where it should be. Not enough recognition of the role that mental health, for example, can play, including amongst younger offenders, it seems to me.
Right.
None of that's been joined together. And the money has never been channeled, actually, to follow the individual. We still operate both our systems and our budgets in government in this country as a whole. In quite a siloed fashion.
Right.
So those are the two bits.
Okay, well, that obviously...
Too siloed.
You speak from vast experience in those respects, and clearly these are things the public need to learn and understand. I mean, obviously, you know, the system is shut down at the moment, but prior to that, and I, as you know, I've been practicing in it for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I mean, over recent years, many, many Crown Courts have closed a large proportion of their courtrooms. Legal aid has been devastated. Many young barristers in my chambers find it pretty difficult to make ends meet. I mean, despite all of those difficulties, I mean, was it your perception that people could still receive a fair trial, meaning that a jury were sort of in a position to reach a just verdict?
Yes, I think they could, but despite some aspects of the system rather than because of it.
Yeah.
Despite everything, and largely, I think, because of the professionalism of the lawyers, solicitors and barristers, and also of the judiciary, people generally can. That doesn't mean that there weren't more failings than there should have been. And I think the underinvestment in the technology to support disclosure in the modern age is a very clear example of that, for example. And there were, therefore, miscarriages of justice around that and other things. And the inability always to get the very best quality of lawyers coming in to criminal work, I think that's also been a failure. Despite that, generally, we have got through. But there wasn't any, very little resilience in the system. So when something like this comes along, then that potentially tips it over the edge.
Yeah, well, that's a very good link in to, you know, what I'd like to discuss with you. What's now happened, as of course you know, is that first, ongoing trials, some of them incredibly serious. For example, the murder of PC Harper at the Old Bailey, which was sort of 3-4 weeks in, other very serious cases. I was due to start a murder trial a week ago, a 6-week murder, which has been put on hold. So trials all across the country have now been put on hold, and very serious cases where people have been in custody for many months are on hold. We don't know when they're going to be tried. I mean, how serious a problem is it that the trial process is now on hold indefinitely?
I think it's a very serious problem. Our committee had raised with the Justice Secretary at our last meeting, and indeed just before the whole of the coronavirus came along, our concerns, growing concerns about the backlog, particularly in the Crown Court. It was already excessive, and you know, I know, like you, Jeremy, people I have friends at the bar who I'm still in touch with, having cases fixed, you know, out to 2021, even before this happened.
Yeah.
And that's just not acceptable. It's not acceptable for defendants, not acceptable for witnesses either. And this certainly has made it much worse. I accept that the problem that the judiciary are confronted with, and it's very difficult to maintain social distancing in a jury trial. I can really see that a problem. But it does indicate that we have not perhaps invested as much as we should have done in technology. If you like, the IT programs that the HMCTS and the Courts and Tribunal Service have been salami sliced somewhat over the years with the MOJ's budget, and therefore it's not as advanced as it had originally intended to be.
Yeah.
It wasn't a perfect system anyway, and we all know things that used to go wrong with it, but we weren't as far forward as we should have been when this came along. The Lord Chief and the other senior judges have given an impetus to doing an awful lot of reasonably effective workarounds, but it's not going to be enough, is it? You can't do a jury trial at the moment on that type of virtual basis.
No, you certainly,
it's simple as that.
You certainly can't. So, I mean, the position at the moment is, I mean, if we just take a case I've recently been involved in by way of example, but there are many, many others, that we have a defendant who has been waiting 11 months for his trial. He's on remand at Belmarsh Prison at the moment.
Yeah.
His case was adjourned, in effect, indefinitely on the 16th of March. There is a holding date, but the likelihood is it won't be tried for very many months. I mean, there are thousands of other people in the same position. I mean, Bob, what you've touched on the dilemma judges have, but what do we do with these people? Do we now keep them in custody, let's say, until next year, meaning that, you know, they would have been in custody for maybe 18 months before their trial? Or do we start granting bail to unconvicted defendants on a much, much more widespread basis?
Well, I think we do have to look at that. I think it can't be acceptable just to load more people into the prison system, because it's not just those who are remanded at the moment. There will be more people coming in, of course. And so I am pleased that the Lord Chancellor, when he was interviewed by our committee about a week or so ago, said that he wanted to look at more use of release on temporary licence for convicted prisoners. That's one way forward.
Yeah.
But I think given that we have now got much better tagging technology and so on, I would have hoped that we could look at anybody, certainly anyone who's involved in non-violent offences. We ought to be looking at, if possible, to release on bail,
yeah,
virtually, perhaps with a sort of a home detention or something like that. Yet again, it proves the point about the underinvestment, because Robert Buckland was talking very sensibly about he'd like to have more bail places available. He's right, but the truth is, this is all we're having to run fast to catch up, aren't we?
Yeah.
Those weren't there, and they're not going to be there in the foreseeable future. You can't conjure those up in a matter of weeks. Now, the other thing I was going to say is, so I think we've got also to look at releasing vulnerable prisoners to make some space in the system for those who perhaps for public protection reasons do still need to be detained. So obviously pretty scandalous that we've got pregnant women in prison, it seems to me, in the current circumstances. People who are coming towards the end of sentences, surely that should be speeded up. Short sentences, perhaps we should be looking again at that. And maybe we have to look at some of those very elderly prisoners, some of whom may have committed quite grave offences
yeah.
in the past,
yeah.
but are very elderly now and not likely to be a physical threat to anybody.
Yeah.
We've got to be prepared to bite the bullet and face down some of the Daily Mail type of knee-jerk criticism.
I suppose it could be said that even whatever type of offender we're dealing with, and on the basis that rehabilitation is said to be a principal objective of imprisonment, that to release unrehabilitated prisoners is always problematic. But I suspect you'd say, well, we're in exceptional times here, so we just have to get on with it.
I think we may have to. I appreciate that that's exactly why you've been looking at each individual case, and that's a lot of work to do. And that's why doing it on temporary licence, so there is still a hold over them, is very important. It proves also the point, perhaps we were making earlier, that that the system was creaking before this happened, because, of course, as we all know, there weren't the rehabilitative programmes always available. There should have been to get them into that place. But it may be that at the moment, in a short-term period, you know, if the Iranians can be releasing thousands of prisoners on furlough, then I'm sure a civilised democracy like the UK can manage it.
Yeah. If I could just come back to prison in just a moment. Can I just ask you this, Bob? You know, drawing upon all your years of practice and you know, being involved at the heart of the Parliamentary Justice Select Committee and so on. I mean, bearing in mind what the backlog was before and the problems that arise now from adjourned trials, I mean, I personally am worried about how the criminal justice process is going to grapple with the system when the world reawakens. You know, the conflict between historic cases that have not yet been tried, cases that are fixed to be tried in the autumn, cases that are due to be tried in January. I mean, how on earth is the system going to deal with this, you know, logjam of cases?
I think it can only do it in two ways. In the short term, I think there's got to be a really significant, very substantial increase in the number of sitting days in the Crown Court. That was already a problem beforehand.
Yeah.
Robert Buckland, the Justice Secretary, said that he was going to add in additional sitting days, quite a number, both this year and next year. Well, he's got to go beyond that. And when we were raising this with him in the Select Committee, he didn't dissent when I pushed him and said, well, truth is, you've got to sit to the physical capacity of the courts to make up for this. So call up every available recorder, make sure that prior priority is being given to getting criminal cases done by everybody who's able to do crime. And then in the longer term, let's also finish off the investment that we need to make sure a lot more of these hearings can be done. At least the preliminary hearings can be done remotely, not just on a temporary basis, but on a permanent one.
Yeah, so that we're
actually freeing up the court time for the trials where you really have to be in court because of, you know, as you and I know, the interface that there's got to be, the human contact between the jury and the witnesses and defendants and so on.
We had on a young guy of 19 who's just been released from a London prison on bail. He was there on remand for his first offence, which was a knife-related offence. But he's been given bail. He was describing how over the last 2 weeks he was in a cell with no windows, where the central heating was turned on full blast. You could actually touch the pipes and burn your hand. He's got asthma. He said that when he complained about having asthma, the prison officers basically said, it's not, we just can't deal with it. There was no other accommodation for him. Visits had been stopped. Phone calls had been stopped. His aunt, who has a very responsible job, was distraught beyond belief. I mean, you know, how are we treating people like this in the year 2020?
It comes back, I think, Jeremy, to that point we were talking about at the beginning, the unwillingness of us as perhaps a society to talk seriously about how we deal with people who break the rules, and what the criminal justice system and the prison system in particular is for, and how it should be used. We never had a grown-up discussion about that. We've rather fallen into sound bites, haven't we, where it's either lock them up and throw away the key sort of thing, or if you suggest otherwise, you're sort of a, quotes, a bleeding heart liberal and so on. And we'd never talk sensibly about is the best way, not only in terms of changing the lives of individuals who get into trouble, actually, what's the best for society? What's the best means of making sure that people don't go on committing offences? You know, fewer offenders means fewer victims. We've never been sensible, I think, about that. And therefore, we've never invested in having the right sort of prisons, more modern prisons. There was, I think, you know, quite a brave attempt when Michael Gove was Justice Secretary, actually, back in 1516, where, if you remember, he was proposing legislation which actually, for the first time, set out a purpose of imprisonment.
Yeah.
With rehabilitation very much at the top.
Yeah.
And quite an ambitious prison building programme. So at least we would have had much more modern estate. And then, sadly, after all else that happened in 2016 and Brexit, that was rather lost in the wash, and perhaps a return to rather more authoritarian attitudes under the next Prime Minister, which I think was a shame.
Yeah.
I hope Boris Johnson, when he comes through this, will be broad-minded enough to realise that it's not just enough to have a Royal Commission on Criminal Justice talking about, you know, the process. It's got to actually look at what's the outcomes that we want in terms of a justice system.
I mean, perversely, maybe the invasion of coronavirus will draw attention to the kind of problems our prisons face that were of little interest to the public before. I mean, that is one possible benefit that could emerge. Would you agree?
I suppose that's right. I think we've got to look in a time like this for some sort of positives or something that we might learn out of this, Jeremy. And that may well be right, because, you know, that situation you describe, these prisons are a petri dish of infection, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that Andrew Neilson was deeply concerned about. Before we move towards conclusion, Bob, can I just ask you about the question of prison officers? Because, you know, I have my own views on what I'll call the quality of prison officers. And I, you know, I respect the effort that everybody makes, you know, and I witness it on a day to day basis as an incredibly hard job. But certainly Andrew Neilson from the Howard League, and indeed in his own way, Alan, the prisoner released from jail recently, have expressed profound concern about the potential for prison officers to deal with problems, and in particular, you know, the coronavirus and everything that it brings. I mean, you know, what's your perception of the training and abilities of prison officers in the modern world?
I think actually, you know, having visited prison quite a lot in a different way to when I used to go and do legal visits, and you're just in that one bit of the prison. Having visited quite a lot with the Justice Select Committee, and we do on a regular basis until this happened, my opinion of the staff in the prison service has gone up a lot, certainly of the people on the ground. I don't think they're always terribly led from the centre, but I hope that will change with the new management they've got. But I do think there's a problem in two respects, Jeremy. They are probably understaffed. We took out too many prison officers during the period, frankly, that Chris Grayling was Justice Secretary. And we're making that up now, but we're just playing catch-up. And the other problem is there are far too many new recruits in the prison service. We've got a real problem retaining sort of experienced officers. And I think that is a real risk very often it's the long-established prison officers who are best at calming down stressful situations, which can then escalate into much worse.
You've got
a lot of youngsters, or comparative youngsters on the wing, without much experience. That's when you can get the reaction to go almost immediately to a fairly draconian response, lockdown, quite very restrictive regimes that actually breeds more problems.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we called in the last parliament for a proper, if you like, recruitment and retention strategy from the prison service for that. I'm afraid we've never really seen that fully delivered yet. That's I think, an error that's been made.
Yeah, I mean, all I can say on prisons, and as you've said, I mean, we as lawyers only see part of the establishments, but I mean, I just feel, and I'm, you know, there's an awful lot about the prison system that is archaic physically and, you know, conceptually. And you know, it may be that Corona is going to prevent too much progress in the near future. But I mean, do you agree with that? That an awful lot of it, you know, needs to be dragged into the year 2020?
Oh, yes. And I think a lot of the good staff that I've met in prisons would agree with that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's not actually a very pleasant environment to work in.
No.
And that makes recruitment much harder, and that's why there's quite a high dropout rate.
Yeah.
That's why I think officers find themselves under pressure, just as inmates are.
Yeah.
And that can lead to bad outcomes.
Absolutely.
Sometimes.
Absolutely.
But we do need a better estate for them to work in, and a better estate for people to be held in and rehabilitated. You can't really do rehabilitation effectively in some of these old Victorian prisons.
No, absolutely. So, Bob, can I ask you finally, you know, we're now in March 2020, COVID-19 dominates the world. What is the priority of the Justice Select Committee?
Well, we want to first of all, we are going to be continuing to scrutinise whilst the outbreak goes on. We've made arrangements where select committees can meet virtually now, and so we can we'll be having briefings next week from the prison service, and then we'll be, once the recess is over, we'll return to doing our public hearings, but we'll be doing it virtually, no doubt operating wherever necessary from home with our witnesses remotely and so on. And the key things I want to look at there are, again, where we are with the prison service, to make sure that we continue to follow up the recommendations that we've made. You know, one of the things I find scandalous is the very small percentage of inspectorate reports that are actually acted upon.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got, in effect, an inspector, not quite a regulator, but an outside body headed up by, you know, some very serious people like Peter Clark, if they make a recommendation, it ought to be the norm that the prison service acts on that recommendation. It's not. So those are things we want to look at. We want to look at the situation around young offenders in particular, because we still don't deal with that satisfactory at any point in the time. We've got an ongoing inquiry on that. And we're going to, I think, to be needing to look at how do we fund the system right the way through from start to finish. Because if you're putting more money into policing, then you must have an equivalent amount of money to go into the Crown Prosecution Service. And you've got to look at legal aid to make sure people are properly defended. And then you've got to look at the investments in the courts as, if you like, the individual and the case flows through the system.
Well, it sounds like, you know, despite what's going on, there's a massive agenda. How can the public actually follow the work that you're doing?
There are two ways you can do it. We have our own website. All of the select committees have our website. So if you type in Go onto the House of Commons website. You can follow the links to the Justice Committee. And we've put up all of our reports, all of our evidence that we received, including evidence, all on there. There's links, transcripts of our hearings, and also links to the web of our hearings. And we're also on Twitter. And I think we may even be on Facebook yet. I don't actually run the IT side of it.
Right, certainly on right. Twitter.
And so people can follow then. And of course, all of our hearings are in public. And even though the last meeting we had, last couple of meetings we had, were without anyone in the public gallery, they were still broadcast. You can get them on Parliament TV, but also, you know, in this day and age, you can follow them, in effect, on demand. You can follow us online as well. And I hope people will.
Well, look, it's incredibly reassuring to know how much work is going on despite, you know, the difficulties we face. And clearly, you know, if it wasn't evident before, it's certainly evident now, you know, what good hands the Parliamentary Justice Select Committee is in. And you've explained things so calmly and clearly. It brings back bad memories of why you always used to win when I was in court against you.
I never kept a score, Jeremy.
Bob, thank you so much for taking so much time to explain the things you're involved in and your vast experience, you know, so clearly. I'm really grateful to you, and good luck with everything.
Well, thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for doing this podcast, because this all helps to get the message out. And I'm really grateful to you too, and it's great to talk to you.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you for listening. Join me again next time for another episode of Justice on Trial. Please don't forget to subscribe. And if you liked what you heard, please give us a good review. And if you have a story you feel is worth sharing, please get in touch by tweeting us at justice_ontrial.